Okay, I was asked to give a little bit of a review on the properties of flux lines, the physics of flux lines in type 2 superconductors. We actually call them flux lines, or more often vortex lines, and you'll see why in a minute. Now, I don't know that many of the solar people are here, but this was kind of motivated by possible analogies with their flux tubes. And so basically what this is an example of a situation where people have actually tried to describe the collective properties of an ensemble of interacting flux lines or flux tubes, we can call them as you wish. And compared to the polymers on one hand and the flux tubes in the sun, they are on one hand a little bit of a simpler system, as you will see, for a couple of reasons. Number one, the flux tubes are most often, although not always, they are directed. They're like directed polymers. Like system more closely analog would be a polymer pneumatic. So they're directed along the field, the direction of the external magnetic field. Although I'll mention at the end situations when one may actually be interested in strongly fluctuating lines and loops and so on. And the other difference is that the medium in which they exist is not a fluid, but it's a crystal. And that has a couple of consequences. It still provides sort of an overdamped dynamics for the flux lines, just like a polymer in a solvent or a flux tubes in the sun. But on one hand, it breaks Galilean invariance. On the other hand, there is because again, there is no solvent, there can be viscosity effects due to the interaction among the lines, but there is no of what in the polymer business people call hydrodynamic interaction. The system, that the fluid responds to the motion of the polymer, the crystal doesn't couple in the same way, it's more of an inert medium. The problem per se is actually has another difficulty which is not present in the context of polymers or flux tubes in the sun, which is actually what the crystal provides usually is material disorder and therefore provides a source of so-called quench disorder. And the properties of the flux lines are affected by this quench disorder. In fact, most of the work in this business has been on trying to understand the role of quench disorder. I will basically say nothing about that because I don't think it's relevant or of interest to people here. But really, that's where the hard problem is in this business, is in coupling the line to both temperature and also quench disorder. Anyway, so let me give you just a little outline of what I plan to do, first of all. So first of all, I'll tell you about a single flux line in a type 2 superconductor, how we can describe it as an elastic string, but with tension. Okay. Then I'll discuss how these lines interact with each other. So what we actually have is an ensemble of interacting lines plus temperature fluctuation. And as I said, in the real problem that people deal with, in general, plus quench disorder that I will not talk about. Then I will tell you a little bit about what are the equilibrium phases. Of this interacting system of lines. And in particular, again, forgetting the disorder, what we can have a situations where these lines arrange themselves in a solid, in a lattice-like structure, or we can have a situation where the lattice melts and what we have is a naturally possibly entangled liquid of lines. And tell you a bit about the property of this liquid of lines. So I won't be talking much about the property of a single line as about the properties of a collection of interacting lines. Okay, then I'll discuss the dynamics. I'll get to the dynamics. So first of all, I'll tell you the dynamics of a single line. And then, referring mainly to the liquid state, I'll discuss how to describe the dynamics of many interacting lines, so let's call it the dynamics of the line liquid, at a kind of a coarse-grained continuum level. And that's where the role of entanglement will come in determining dissipation effects associated with viscosity, possibly also actually viscoelastic effects like the ones that were mentioned yesterday. And maybe at the end, I'd like to say something about how one may go about why one may be interested in describing an ensemble of actually both directed lines plus loops, and one how one may go about that. Okay. Now, by the way, I also realized talking to some of the people in the solar program that although this may be very different from the lines, the flux lines in the sun, they could actually be relevant to neutron stars, where there is actually superconductivity and the relaxation of magnetic field may be determined by the dynamics of fluxoids of this type that I'll talk about. Anyway, I thought I'll just start by showing you that, just like you see the picture of the sunspots, these objects have been imaged for a long time. Now there's no signal. Actually, yeah, but I changed my mind anyway. Before I show you the image, I want to tell you what the flux lines are, I think. So let me tell you what they are first of all. Okay, so this is all a little bit. Did I get the thing on? Yeah, I guess so. Superconductor is a material that has zero resistivity, and a type 1 superconductor, if you place it in an external magnetic field, expels the field. There is no field inside. I'm interested in type 2 superconductors, which are materials that have a region of magnetic fields where the field is not completely expelled, but it penetrates in the form of flux bundles, which are actually quantized. Each one of them carries one quantum of magnetic flux. And in this state, the material, so if you wanted to make a kind of a rough picture, okay, so here is your superconductor. You place it in a magnetic field, and this will always be my z direction. In a type 1 system, and of course the superconductor is some piece of material, in a type 1 system, the field is expelled from the inside. Of course, it penetrates a small width called the penetration length at the surface. In the type 2 system, the field penetrates and it forms regions where the material is essentially normal. So what you get really is a mixed state, is a superconducting matrix with this shaded cylindrical region that are really normal material, so that the magnetic field penetrates in the normal region, and each one of them carries one quantum, is on the average aligned with the external field, and carries one quantum of magnetic flux phi naught. Now, one of the reasons there's been a lot of it, and you get a collection of many of these, as are called flux lines, that are interacting with each other, and as we will see, they really determine the properties of the material. So one of these flux lines, if you like, let me just kind of draw it here again, can be really thought of as a normal region of some size, known as the core size or the coherence length, let's call it xi, which is really the length scale over which superconductivity, you know, varies. The material goes from normal to superconductor. It carries, if you like, it's a region where you have a tight collection of field lines. It carries a quantum of magnetic flux, phi naught. Outside, you have superconducting material, but the field is not confined to this normal region. It spills out a penetration length, or if you use also a screen, that are actually supercurrents. That's why it's called also a vortex line. They circulate around the flux lines, and they spill out in the superconductor a length called lambda, or penetration length. Type 2 materials always have xi smaller than lambda, and in particular, I'm interested in material, all the so-called high TC superconductors are of this type, that are, let's say, very type 2. Xi is much smaller than lambda. Okay, so these are the first two length scales, if you like, in our problem. Xi, the size of the core, and lambda, the length scale over which the magnetic field spills out into the superconductor. Because Xi, in the material that one has been interested in lately, Xi may be of the order of, say, 15 angstrom. Lambda is always bigger than, say, 1500 angstrom, so there is a big separation. So you can really think of this as kind of a string-like object.
Can you the energetics, why these things are stable?
Because
I used to know.
Okay, well, what happens is, I wasn't going to, but you know, I can't, because it could take like a week of lectures to go through everything. But basically what happens in the, so type one, okay, let me say, Xi, okay, what do you have in a superconductor? Superconductor, there's some order parameter which you can think of vaguely. Well, it's a wave function, but the magnitude square is the density of superconducting electrons. Okay, so say that is 1 in the superconductor, 0 in the normal metal. If you had a normal superconducting interface, Xi would be the length scale over which the order parameter varies. Okay, that's that length scale. The magnetic field is expelled, but it penetrates the length scale lambda. So lambda is the length scale over which the fields, B or even electrical fields, vary. Okay. Type 1 always says Xi bigger than lambda. There's a root 2 factor, actually, that goes in here. What this does, you can actually do a calculation, I mean, and show that what happens in this case is that the surface energy for a normal to superconducting interface is always positive. That surface energy, so basically, see, the material, by going superconductor, acquires, clearly, there's a condensation energy, which is negative for that state to be stable. But it costs energy to expel the magnetic field. So the balance of these two gives you surface energy for the normal superconducting interface that you can calculate, depends on the field and the material parameter. When this is true, the surface energy is positive. When Xi is smaller than lambda, the surface energy can become negative.
So why do they remain straight?
I'll get to that.
Okay.
I'll get to straight.
One would imagine that if it became negative, you would want to create arbitrary amounts.
Well, okay, now the question could be, I mean, there is an external field outside, so the magnetic field tends to be aligned with the external field. Now the question could be, well, why not regions of stripes, labyrinth, all kinds of pattern, in a mixed state with all kinds of patterns separating normal.
The H implies that the field has to go all the way through.
Right.
Could you imagine an arbitrarily complicated wandering that would give you more length?
Right.
You could win on the line tension.
Well, but you don't. If you do the calculation, you can show that the
isotropy or something like that.
No, it's not so much crystalline isotropy. It's really the line tension, which I was going to estimate for you in a minute. It's really the line tension that basically always wins. Coupled with the fact, because I mean, it costs, you know, clearly costs energy to deviate.
Between line tension and surface energy. I guess that's
surface energy, absolutely. Well, there are three things actually. Surface energy becoming negative means the material wants to create normal superconducting interface. Okay. Now, let's first of all think of a thin film. So we don't worry about the wandering you are interested in. Okay. You can still ask, well, why? In the thin film, there will be vortex points or flux points, okay? Why flux points as opposed, I don't know, stripes, anything else? Well, that comes from a couple of, one reason is the quantization of the flux, okay, which is a crucial point. And another reason comes that you just can actually do the calculation and show that this is the state of minimum energy. Now, when you make it thick, then you can also have the lines wander this way, and that is just basically the line tension at the kind of low temperature and always swims. And so.
Also be repulsion between the
lines. Yes, I'll get to that. I only have one line so far, so I don't, you know, that's actually, okay, let me just go a step further, then maybe you can ask me again if you, okay?
Another general question. This happens only at a large magnetic field. I mean, there is this high field.
Right, there is the so-called mean field. These results come out from at the level of kind of Ginzburg-Landau type theory, if you know what that is. If you don't, forget it. But there is a so-called mean field phase diagram that you can draw in the temperature applied field plane. Okay, so if you have no field, some TC above which the material is normal, below which is superconductor. Now you apply the magnetic field. It costs energy. First thing that the superconductor tries to do is expel the field. It costs energy to do so. Okay, and so TC in some sense decreases, and there is some characteristic field as a function of temperature above which this type 1 superconductivity is destroyed. Okay, so here it's called, it said that the material is a Meissner, it's called Meissner effect, which refers to this field expulsion. Okay, if it is type 2 in the sense the parameters have the right ratio, you increase the field, it doesn't go normal, it goes into the mixed, this mixed state where vortex line penetrates, and then there's a second critical field above which eventually goes normal. Okay. Now, it turns out, by the way, that in high-TC superconductors that people have been studying lately, this field may be 100 Gauss, this field may be 300 Tesla. So there's lots of interest in this region in between. Now it's incredibly hot in here. By the way, it's getting hotter and hotter. Maybe it's just me, but I complained it was cold. And so I don't know if that's what you were asking, but that's, so we are looking at things in this region. Okay?
Oh, heat now.
Yeah, now there's a lot of heat coming in. I can feel it because I'm standing here. But anyway. Okay, so actually, I wanted to define three length scales in the problem. Okay? The core size, the lambda, the length scale over which the supercurrent or the field spills outside. And now there's a third length scale that becomes relevant if we put in one more line, which is the average distance between the lines. And of course, that's set by the magnetic field. Because if you, roughly speaking, if you apply a field H, or if, say, if a field H penetrates, I should call it B really, field B penetrates in the material, this would be the BZ in the Z direction, each line carries one quantum of flux phi naught. So you can define a density per unit area by this equality. And so A is just 1 over square root of n, and so A goes like square root of phi naught over B, and if B is of order of the applied field, which often is, but not quite, it goes like 1 over H. So at high fields, the lines can be close together, and at low fields, they're far apart. Okay? So that's the third line scale in the problem. Now, one thing about this system is that A can be changed very easily. And there is a huge range of H, of A, of separation that you can probe. So what happens, you can really go from situation where you have strongly interacting arrays of lines to weakly interacting arrays of lines by tuning a parameter, the field, which is very easy to tune experimentally. Okay. Now, there is a... see what I wanted to say. Okay, there is, as was mentioned, there is a repulsive interaction. There's an interaction between the lines which comes about because of the repulsive interaction between the magnetic field carried by the two lines, carried by each line. And it's actually is a repulsive interaction at large distances which becomes attractive at very short distances when the lines overlap. Oh, no, I know. Sorry, I need to... I want to keep track of what I wanted to do. Okay, take a while. We'll get eventually to entanglement. But okay, one more thing before I get to the interaction. If I am in a regime where xi is really the smallest length in the problem, I can really describe this as a string. I will describe, this is called the London limit, and there are many physical properties that cannot be described in this limit that depend on the details of what happens in here, but there are others that can, and I'm going to be thinking about this limit. I can describe this as a string with tension, because there is an external field that breaks the symmetry, and so clearly there'll be an energy cost for the line to get longer, as it was pointed out. I just want to very simply estimate the energy per unit length, the energy per unit length of the line, which is usually called epsilon 1. And the simplest way, clear, the energy per unit length is really, again, determined by this combination of core energy to the fact that the material is normal here and field energy. But a very simple estimate can be obtained as following. We can just estimate it as the field energy in the core. Okay, so basically, the energy density is b squared over 8 pi, where b is the field carried by the flux line. So the field carry is phi naught times the area over which it extends, which is pi lambda square. So this is v square over 8 pi. Okay, this is energy density. Now we multiply by the area again with that energy per unit length. And this is essentially the line energy. So what you get, final square divided 8 pi lambda square, is essentially the line, the energy per unit length of one of these lines. Okay? Now, this simple estimate is not quite right, but it's actually because I am neglecting the fact that there is energy associated with making the material normal in here, but that is only wrong by a logarithmic factor. I see many perplexed faces, but. Oh, yeah, so, no. Oh, sorry, phi naught divided and then times. Yeah, sorry. That's a flux. Yeah. Okay. So that's just a simple estimate of the energy. And we'll get to how big that is in a minute. Okay.
The underlying assumption is that the field, is it the size of that thing adjusts so the field energy is comparable to the energy that you're ignoring?
Yeah, and it is. You can do a detailed calculation, and it is. And the true epsilon 1 line energy comes out to be this. I think there's a 4 here rather than an 8. And then there is a log of kappa, where kappa is lambda over psi. And the fact that psi comes in tells you that this calculation includes things happening in the core on short scales that I'm neglecting here. Okay? So, but it's basically the right, just gives you a good estimate, just calculating the field energy. Okay?
So does that mean that most of the energy is the magnetic energy?
No, it just means they're of the same order.
Okay, but it's not actually mostly condensation energy.
There are two energies. There's a condensation energy in the core that's confined to a region psi, and there's the magnetic energy which is confined to region extended region lambda. This just says these energies are actually of the same order, and to really get the right answer, you have to include them both.
Sort of very argument.
Okay. But yeah, but you know, I don't want to get into the core. I mean, we're not getting into the core here. That's what real people who do real superconductivity do, which is not even me. I mean, I do strings, not okay. So now, all right, so now suppose you wanted to write so let's just write the energy of one of these lines. So let's take just one line, and just now I'll just draw it because I'm forgetting the core. Let's parameterize it by, let's call this R1 of S. Now, clearly, for this problem, there is a convenient choice of S, which is S, we take for S, we take Z, and then we will write R1 of S as, let me write it as Z, little r of Z, where little r of Z will be the position in the xy plane at some height Z, okay? So that the energy of one line, I could write it as epsilon 1. Now, this is not quite right, and I'll tell you why later, but I could write it as epsilon 1, the integral 0 to L, L is the thickness of the sample, of dz, 1 plus dr over dz square. And if my fluctuations are relatively small, this is approximately epsilon 1 L plus epsilon 1 over 2, dr over dz square. And so, see, this is a line, it describes, actually, we usually call this tilt, we don't call it, but this is essentially what, this is a line with tension, and this is the quantity that was called T or R prime or various notations in a number of previous talks, okay? Now, you could ask, so then at this level, you could ask, the first thing you could ask is just to say, well, how good is the approximation that these lines are almost straight, or how far do they actually wander as they traverse the sample in the z direction? Now, notice that the length of the line is not fixed here. The line is a line of magnetic field, always has to go all the way across the system, okay? So the quantity you could calculate is some kind of mean square displacement. And of course, this is, you think of Z as a time-like variable. This is just pure diffusion. There is no quarter power here because there is tension. And of course, you calculate these at large distances, it will go like 2 kBT divided by epsilon 1 Z. And it introduces a length scale, which is really a diffusion constant. But I would like to call it LP, although to be a persistence length, it would have it has a strange dependence, but let's call it LP. It introduces a length scale, which will become important when we are going to get to talk about entanglement. Now, you could ask how big this length scale is. And the point is that, depending on material parameters, it can go anywhere from 10 to 1,000 angstrom. So what that tells you is that thermal wandering, because the temperature is relatively high, can actually be important in this material. And so the approximation of the lines being straight may not be such a good one, but we'll come back to that. Okay. So for now, so there are these flux lines. Each one carries one quantum magnetic flux, so they're all the same. I will describe them, for a while at least, as elastic string with tensions, of non-tension. Now, in general, in real materials, by the way, these, the line energy and the tilt energy are actually different because the materials are anisotropic, but I don't want to get into that. Okay? Are there any questions?
Actually, one. You somehow buried the fact that the energy of the vortex line must depend on the presence of a magnetic field. That is, there has to be some accounting for the cost or actually the benefit of not forcing the field to go around the sample.
Yeah.
Penetrate the sample instead, which is presumably why you get a Meissner phase as well.
Right. Account for that's right. I mean, that's in this business about I mean, the energy per se at this level, this energy doesn't really depend. If that's, are you looking for a dependence?
I guess it is true that the fields go through the sample in order to avoid compressing field lines elsewhere in the universe outside the sample.
Okay.
I'm just wondering where that
right, this certainly comes in the calculation of showing that the equilibrium state of the system is one where you get a penetration of flux lines, and it comes in, you know, is one where you get this flux line penetrating the material and arranging themselves in a particular way that I'll tell you about in a second, at some particular separation and so on.
But I guess what you say that after you've determined...
After that has happened...
You don't worry about it.
I don't worry about it here, no. I mean, so I'm assuming, and you know, and that calculation, I was not going to go through that here because it's rather, it's kind of another thing altogether. But yes, that certainly plays a role.
That's my question. I was implicitly comparing with zero temperature, zero energy. Clearly.
Sorry?
I was worrying about the sign of the tension.
Okay, now this tension is always the way I define it here, because I'm saying, you know, this situation, lines penetrating, a particular number of them in a particular arrangement, you can actually show this the equilibrium state of the system. When you take into account all these energies,
absolutely,
you show this is the equilibrium state of the system. Now I'm just saying, and by the way, in mean field, the equilibrium state of the system, maybe I should say that at the beginning, is one where the lines are straight, rigid sticks, and they arrange themselves in a triangular lattice, called the Abrikosov lattice, if you look at positions this way. Now I'm kind of looking at fluctuations about that state, induced by temperature, say. Okay, maybe I didn't make that clear. Absolutely. It's all hidden away. So I'll be just talking about these kind of strings, elastic strings with tension for a while now. Now, the other thing that I should tell you is about the interaction. There is a repulsive interaction, which is actually what determines this equilibrium state of the lattice, of course. There is a repulsive interaction among the lines, which in general, that can be calculated. So essentially what you do, you take the magnetic energy of the system, which is B squared over 8 pi plus the kinetic energy of all the supercurrents, and in the approximation in which xi is much smaller than lambda, you can recast that, essentially, as a pair interaction among all these lines. Okay? So there's a pair interaction among the lines. So the total magnetic energy, essentially, can be written as some pairwise potential. Sorry, I should write Okay, let me just use S rather than Z for a minute. So I'll write S prime, some pairwise potential, parametrize in terms of line I and line J, generally depends on the magnitude of these two. Okay, so essentially you recast the magnetic energy in that form. And by the way, this includes the sum over I equal to J, okay, which is different from, because, okay, let me tell you what the interaction is. So let's take two lines. That interaction is a repulsive interaction between any two elements of line at Ri and Rj. It depends on separation, but line elements at different horizontal position and a different vertical position interact, as well as the line elements will interact with the other ones on the line. So there is a self-energy term which can be calculated, and in some approximation gives you that, but it's generally a little bit more complicated. It actually has no localities in the z direction and so on. So that's just a simple thing. The form of this interaction is actually rather simple. Essentially, in this, let's call it V of rho is just rho now, I'm calling rho the magnitude of Ri minus Rj. V of rho is essentially goes like e to the minus rho over lambda divided by the square root of rho. Although you also need a short distance cutoff of the order of xi. This expression doesn't apply of line scalars. So perhaps one thing you could do it is to replace rho by the square root of rho square plus xi square, or there are other ways of doing it. I mean, you can introduce the cutoff. There is angular, you can write it in various ways that actually might display better. There's a complicated angular dependence, actually, okay, of the interaction. And if I were, just maybe this might help, okay, if I were to look at the interaction among two segments at the same height, just to make it simple, two straight segments at the same height, then this V as a function of rho will look something like that. Well, I kind of, actually I should make it a little bit more, okay? Where this is xi, there's a finite barrier. Xi, the attraction is repulsive at large distances, attractive at short distance, and this may be lambda. Of course, they might be more separated.
There is a dip, you say?
No, there's no dip. There is a...
What do you mean attractive at short distance?
Well, the repulsive interaction diverges at short distances, but is cut off by an attraction that plays a role on short line scales. So overall, you get a finite height there. Okay. So it is this repulsive interaction that determines the fact that when you have a number of these lines in equilibrium, in the mean field, they will form this lattice. They arrange themselves into this lattice of lines. They're held together by the interaction. And it's a lattice as a shear modulus. People have calculated it as elastic constant. It's a soft lattice, actually. It's a rather soft lattice. But what can happen? So if we perhaps go back to this I drew this phase diagram, and I said this was mean field. So here you have your Meissner phase, here it's normal, and here is this mixed phase. Now in mean field, this mixed phase, these lines form a lattice known as the Abrikosov lattice. What can actually happen though, because of thermal fluctuation, is that this lattice can actually melt in a liquid of lines. So there is a line here. Now I'm not going to say something, well, something like that. We're now here, and now this maybe is no longer true transition. We're going beyond mean field. This is a liquid of lines. And by liquid of lines, what I mean now is that if I look at the position of the lines in a plane perpendicular to the field, there's no longer range order of those positions. The lines, the system has zero shear modulus, it flows. If you probe it, and there are ways of doing that. And furthermore, the original suggestion by us is that she's an entangled liquid, meaning that the thermal, the transverse fluctuations are large enough, and we'll get to that in a minute, to make the liquid entangled. So you go from a picture of rigid sticks arranged in a triangular lattice to a picture of these fluctuating lines that may even wrap around each other and arrange in some kind of a disorder fashion.
Is it really a bulk thing? I mean, ignoring the entanglement issue, that obviously clearly put that on depends on geometry, how thick the sample is, and so on, whether it can or not entangle. But just as a bulk phase diagram, it seems to me whether you have a lattice or whether you go to a liquid clearly depends on these interactions, which, since they're not just point-like interactions in the same plane, it seems like there's a geometric dependence there too.
I believe yes, but let me tell you what the status is. This is actually a first-order phase transition. Originally, people made analogies with Kostelitz Tauletz because, after all, this is a system which is in between and so on. But actually, this has been shown experimentally. This has been seen experimentally. This is a first-order phase transition. People have measured the jump in entropy, I mean, the latent heat of the transition. They have measured the jump in density at the transition. So this is really characterized as a first-order phase transition. As a result, there's no real theory of the transition beyond Lindemann criteria type calculation. It is believed to be a true bulk phase, yes. And the fact that the
interaction would be independent of sample thickness.
I don't see why the entanglement issue will depend on sample thickness, of course.
Is there some sample thickness beyond which those at very short distances, the boundaries must depend on the sample thickness?
Oh, yeah. I mean, but this is the limit L going to infinity. I'm talking about the thermodynamic limit.
So
if you go to thin system, yes. Yeah.
Okay, so it's a sort of funny bulk thickness.
In two dimensions, it's well known, it's been known for a long time, actually, that there is such a melting and that there is a Kostelitz-Tauletz transition. So.
Okay.
This is very different kind of. Okay.
So this dotted line, you mean that transition is basically like liquid to gas transition now, right? It's not a first-order.
Possibly. Well, it's no longer a transition here. You can define it experimentally, but there's no real. There was a mean field line, and why?
So in other words, for
the question of whether the liquid of lines is different from the normal metal, I'll get to it a little bit later. It's something that is not really understood.
So for a type 2 superconductor, if it's just been destroyed by high field, within it you still have like a very non-uniform distribution of magnetic field. Perhaps
when we talk about these liquid of lines, right, we are just describing a very anisotropic, the system with very anisotropic distribution of fields, and this is a convenient way of describing it. That's, yes, but it's still a question that is not completely settled. I'll say something about this a little later, but okay, well, yeah.
Experimentally, do you have any handle on the order parameter in the liquid phase?
Well, it's a related question, exactly. So by liquid now, I'm just referring to the positions. So you have this lattice of lines, think of the lines of the physical entities. And I am just talking about the translational order of the lines. Yes, there is also neutron scattering data, by the way, that actually probe that directly and see going from the lattice to the liquid, in addition to thermodynamic measurements. So yes, that has been seen. But the question you might be asking is, well, is this still a superconductor, a superconducting order parameter? That's a different question. I'll get to that. I'll say something shortly, OK? About that. Oh, I was going, since Chris went to the trouble. Yeah.
I vaguely remember the word exotic phase in this context. Is that?
This is really I don't want to go. This is really exotic, and by the way, it's one of the systems which experimentally the best evidence has been obtained for exotic order. Okay.
So the flat line actually.
If you look at the positions in the plane, there is exotic, there is long-range orientational order, and that's been seen very convincingly in this
even
system.
Even very thick sample.
Well, okay, let me show the picture. The most, I want to show you. I can see these lines actually. Okay, so now everything has gone to sleep at this point. How do I do that?
What about your computer?
Well, the computer should be able to. wake it up pretty easily, but. Okay, now this is warming up. There's a very old technique for imaging. There are lots of techniques for imaging flux lines. I just want to show you these lines are really there. The oldest technique is so-called bitter decoration, which is essentially an iron filing experiment. Of course, there are no experimentalists here, so I can say that. You sprinkle iron filings at the top of the sample. They're held in place by van der Waals forces, and you take a picture. And I mean, this was done first in, I don't know, 1960. And you image the position of the flux lines. Of course, you image the tip of the flux lines. And this also only works at rather low fields. And so, and what you see is, so these white kind of dots will be the place where the flux lines are located. And you see these rather ordered pattern. That's the autocorrelation function to show you the hexagonal symmetry. This looks also very dense. You have lots of these vortex lines, but actually this is rather low field, so this is a very large separation among the vortex lines. At the kind of fields where you are interested in thinking about the liquid of lines, then the separation between the flux lines may be more of the order of, let's say, 200, 400 angstrom, much higher fields of a few Tesla as opposed to this field, and then they're much more strongly interacting. You can also do neutron scattering and then actually measure the structure inside. Okay, but that's indirect. It's not an image like this. So this is, but this is a rather old picture. The kind of thing you can do now.
How is the right image obtained? Is this some kind of Fourier transform?
Yeah. Yeah.
How is it actually obtained?
Oh, basically, the people who do these kind of experiments got together with the people working on colloids for a long time, and they use the same software. To basically digitize, they have a software to locate the center of the little pile of iron filings, and they use software to digitize these images, and then they do all kinds of studies. Beyond these, they also look at the structure of defects in great detail and so on. Okay, so that's another. Imaging technique that was started used actually this was a Japanese group who got this to work to study what this is so-called Lorentz microscopy. It's essentially an electron transmission microscope image where the electrons are scattered by the local fields, they're deflected very slightly, and then you build in a holography technique, you build an out of focus image, and the dimple that you see are the vortices. And what the people can do nowadays is actually image the vortices. As they move through the sample, they raise and decrease the magnetic field. And by doing that, they can see the vortices. They move in and out or through the sample. And so they can study the dynamics, again, of the tips, if you like. They can study the dynamics in great detail. These particular pictures have increasing field and then decreasing again. And actually, there are vortices moving in a situation where there is an artificially engineered array of square symmetry of defects that can pin the vortices. That's why you see this square kind of structure building in.
And these are holes that drill out.
These are holes, yes. These are actually little, the defects are little holes that they drill in the material because a hole is a normal region and the vortex would prefer to sit there. And these pictures are not very visible. These are much fewer vortices. And I mean, the nice thing here is when you can see the movie. So I'll try to see if we can. Okay, this is so small, the picture, that we enlarge it and so. But you can actually follow the motion of these vortices and really look at real-time dynamics. And here, particularly one is interesting here in when you have this order underneath, how they dip in and how they move in.
They hop from one pin side to another?
They tend to diffuse between and then hop from one pin side to the other, yes. Although that depends a lot on the regime you are in. I mean,
it's just the motion seems quite sudden.
That's right. Sometimes it depends on. that was kind of. All I want to kind of say is that one can actually. In some sense, studying vortices and superconductor has become kind of a play field for studying all these kinds of systems where you have interactions and driven dynamics and disorder, because you can look at them in great detail and tune some simple knobs experimentally like the field and go into a completely different regime. But I would like to get to what I was going to say, which is, okay, the liquid. I want to talk about the liquid, because if anything, that's what has any relevance here. So you have a liquid of these strings interacting with each other, and they can actually be driven to move by applying a current. So actually, before I talk about the liquid, I need to get to that. How do vortices move?
Are there any variphases as you go along the vortex?
Yes, variphases. There are lots of variphases, actually, that come in vortices, because a lot of things can actually be recast in that language. So, okay, but let me just tell you one more simple ingredient here. So I would like to get to talk about dynamics, but I need to tell you about just one, how one vortex will move. So to talk about how one vortex will move, let's go back to a single vortex, which is now just a rigid stick, okay? And now I call it vortex. Remember, it's a flux line, and it's a vortex of supercurrent, okay? And the vortex is crucial to understand how it moves. So let's look at the cross-section. Let's first of all consider the case of, say, a superfluid. Okay, so it's now a vortex, not moving in a crystal, but moving in a fluid. And so imagine a superfluid. We are at T equals zero, so there is no normal fluid, there is no frame of reference, nothing. So we may have, say, this is my vortex. There might be some superimposed motion in the superfluid. So let me go to a frame of reference where the vortex is at rest. So let's call V the velocity, if any, of the vortex. And let's call Vs the velocity of the surrounding superfluid. Let me go to a frame of reference where the vortex is at rest. And so the superfluid is moving asymptotically far away with velocity Vs minus V. Okay. Now, this is just... We know that like a cylinder rotating in a fluid, there'll be a so-called Magnus force, the Bernoulli effect, if you like, that provides a transverse lift. So the Magnus force, you can show, I think in this case we'll go up, although I have not very, okay, will be given by rho, the superfluid density in this case, Vs minus V cross the circulation, which in the case of my superconducting vortex is just the flux quantum times Z, okay? Now, if there are no other forces acting on the vortex, okay, the net force, that this must be zero, which means that your vortex is just riding along with the fluid, okay? So in a superfluid, at zero temperature, there is no normal fluid, there is complete Galilean invariance, all the vortex can do is ride along with the fluid. If there is a superfluid, if there is a normal fluid, then this can provide some scattering and things can be different, but otherwise, this is what happens, okay? In a superconductor, the situation is a little different because the crystal provides a frame of reference, breaks the Galilean invariance. So what happens is that in addition to this Magnus force...
I always understood that superfluids never became 100% superfluid, if not what was 15% or...
This is true. So I'm just thinking about this ideal example, okay, right now. Okay. In a superconductor, so this may not be what actually happens, but if there was... nothing exerting a drag on the vortex will ride along with the fluid, okay? In the superconductor, there is always a drag, no matter what you do, because there's the underlying crystal that provides a frame of reference. Then you have to calculate what the drag on the vortex due to the crystal is. Now, this is a microscopic calculation because the drag arises from the interaction of these normal electrons in the core with the crystal, and in fact the outcome is that it depends on things like the normal state resistivity and so on. It's a microscopic calculation, and actually it's not even fully understood. There are still people still arguing about this. But most people will agree that the form of this, let's call it drag, due to the lattice, is something like this. Gamma V, I'll write it and then I'll tell you what. Okay, this will be again my superfluid, if you like, or superconductor density. Gamma and V are friction, gamma and beta are friction parameters that depend on material property. So this is a friction force. There is also a transverse friction, if you like. And I really don't want to get into explaining this, if possible. The only thing I want to say, now, these things...
The V is the V of the
vortex or flux line, which is just a rigid stick coming out of the board. Okay? There is a drag. So this is just a conventional drag. Gamma depends on the normal state, electron photon scattering time, so it depends on a very low temperature, will mostly depend on impurities in the material. So will beta, for that matter. Okay? Now, in most materials that are relevant for superconductors, it turns out that beta is very close to 1. Okay? So what happens when you actually equate when you put these two forces together, let's see, did I get the size right? Maybe not. Should I have a minus sign here, you're saying?
No, for the drag, the force should be opposite of the velocity.
Oh, okay. In fact, that solves my minus sign problem. That's the drag. And now when I put them together, and require this equal to 0, what happens if beta is equal 1, these two terms cancel, and the equation of motion just becomes gamma v equals rho s vs cross, let me just write it as phi naught z. Okay? And so the vortex in the superconductor, in the dirty superconductor happens, actually moves transverse to the flow. In reality, moves to an angle, and that calls something called Hall resistance. But I'm not going to get into that. But there is lots of materials which, to a good approximation, it moves transverse to the flow. Okay, and this is a point of that kind. All right. So in my superconductor, what happens is something like this. If I have my vortices here. Okay. And so the field is coming out. I apply a current that will move this way. Transverse to the field and transverse to the applied current. So now, roughly speaking, what you have is a magnetic field moving transverse to the current. There'll be an induced EMF. I mean, there are better ways describing this, including, but roughly what happens is that there'll be an induced electric field, which can be simply calculated for one vortex as 1 over C, the field carried by that one vortex, cross the velocity. And now if you put in the velocity from this expression, what you're going to get is,
What's J? It just lost me when you sped up.
Yeah, I realize. So in this picture, what was the supercurrent? The supercurrent could have been current due, it could have been a current distribution due to the other vortices, or it could have been an externally applied current, okay? So actually for now, I want to think about only one vortex, so I really don't want to have the current distribution of the other vortices. Instead, I'll put in an applied external current, okay? So I'll put in an applied external current, so I need some charge here, I believe. So basically, this becomes J. Okay. So I have what is called the Lorentz force on the vortex, which is J cross with the magnetic field. And now if I put in here from that equation, the V equals 1 over gamma. I think I lost some Cs also somehow. I should have a 1 over C J cross phi naught Z. I end up with something that says this is phi naught over C squared, 1 over gamma J, I end up with Ohm's law. Okay? So a single vortex, or many non-interacting vortices, then I just multiply this by a factor of density. Many non-interacting vortices, straight vortices, you apply a current, they move transverse to the current, this induces an EMF in the direction of the original current, and if that's your equation of motion, or you know, just drag, no interaction among the vortices, you just get Ohm's law. Okay? And this is seen. That's why people want to pin the vortices, but we're not going to talk about pinning and disorder. Now, the point where I think there might be finally some analogy with is coming now is the following, is that basically now, if you have a liquid of lines, and they're interacting and possibly entangled, in addition to the drag on each single vortex line that is that, you can actually have another source of dissipation, which is viscosity of this interacting liquid of line. Not viscosity coming from interaction with the solvent, but viscosity coming from interaction among the lines and entanglement. Okay? And that will modify this picture. You won't have Ohm's law anymore, among other things. So what you like to do now is to describe the dynamics of these collections of things. And one way to do it is do it at a continuum level, develop some kind of a hydrodynamics of this system of lines, and try to estimate the viscosity and see what effect this viscosity can have on eventually the transport properties of the material, the relationship between J and E. Yeah.
In the your induction equation, I guess I don't understand. You're relating E to the time derivative of B.
I'm really relating E to the rate of change of the flux. Okay. No. This is B. I'm writing E 1/c B cross V. B is, let's call it maybe B1, is the field of one of these vortex lines. Okay? But where really this comes from, there are better ways of describing this. What really comes from is that you can show that, so as the flux moves across here, there's a rate of change of flux that induces a voltage, essentially, across. It's okay. Josephson effect.
Okay, I guess. So it's not, if it was just at a coarse grained level, if I was just doing electromagnetic induction, the fact that these flux lines moved, there would be no change in the average magnetic field in a region. That's why I'm.
That is true. At this level, I'm not doing coarse graining. I'm looking at a single line. And that is important, because what is important here is that one line moving across, you know, changes the change in flux. The rate of
transferring momentum to the electromagnetic. Transferring momentum to the electromagnetic field, that's essentially dissipation. Because the way you're describing, you're saying the Lorentz force is acting on the magnetic flux line.
Well, it really.
Backwards to the way we normally
think of it. That's true. That is true.
So you're actually transferring momentum to an electromagnetic degree of freedom, which would be really going so.
That might be one way of thinking. That's not the way usually people think about it here, but maybe I think that might be one way of thinking it. Yeah, thinking
of
it.
It changes, but a change, like for instance, if the flux moves, it's going up here, above the flux.
But what matters is the rate of change. D phi over dt there's a constant rate of change of flux because the flux is moving at a steady pace.
If I have a blob of flux that's moving up, and I have a rate of change here. It's increasing here, but it's decreasing here. So I'll get electric.
No, but they come in. They keep coming in. This is steady.
I'm talking about in the region of. So you said I should not coarse grain them and average over many fluxes. So I'm now looking at a single flux.
Yeah.
And the details of the electric field around it. And just saying it appears.
You have to look at a steady stream of fluxons, and actually the fact that they are each one carries a quantum of flux is also important. You have to look at a steady stream of fluxons, then you can show that when one moves across the sample and the flux and carries one quantum of flux across the sample, there is a voltage change in the other direction, which corresponds to that. It's a subtle thing. I was just trying actually to give a simple argument people might believe, but it's actually a subtle thing here. Okay. Okay, so let me just kind of outline what I wanted to get to here. If I can have a little bit more time. I could, in principle, write down Langevin equations for all these interacting lines, okay? And I would write something like this. Well, here I will have a term. I like to write it like this. I think I have a minus. J, including J, equal to I. I will write this Lorentz force. In general, I'm interested in a situation where I'm driving the system with an external applied current, which is this. And so it will couple, in general, it couple to the local, what I really want to write, really what I will have is DRI with respect to S. I should really worry about normalizing it but that's for small fluctuations, and then thermal noise, okay? So in general, the Lorentz force, the line is no longer straight, and so if it's coupled to the local direction of the line, this is actually a rather complicated term in terms of directions and various, which contains a lot of the things that have been discussed here, okay? But one way to go about it would be to try to study this problem, but that's clearly very hard, okay? So what I want to do instead is to construct some kind of a coarse-grain theory, so define coarse-grain fields, and then tell you what the hydrodynamic equation should be like. So natural coarse-grain, well, the first coarse-grain field you want to introduce is something related to the density of lines. So in general, again, now going back to these directed lines for now, where I parameterize the position in terms of Z and R perp. Okay, so I parameterize the position in terms of a bigger I of Z, which is the collection of Z and R perp of Z. Okay? The density of lines is actually a vector, which in a coarse-grain manner I could define like this. This would be a three-dimensional vector. Okay? And clearly, it has the Z component is just an aerial density, and the perp component is something that I will call T, which we call tilt vector because it tells you about the local deviation from the alignment with the Z direction. Okay? The Z component, if you like, Ri, is just gets one here, so that's an aerial density, and the perp component is the local tilt away from the direction of alignment. Now, this is nothing but your local induction, roughly speaking, in the sense that the two-dimensional density of lines corresponds to the Z component of the local field, and this tilt vector corresponds to the perp component. Although the relationship, they're not simply proportional to each other, the relationship is actually spatially non-local because of this interaction having a finite extent and so on. But physically, I am just using the local field due to the line. Okay? Yeah.
Is this similar to the other polymer?
Yeah, this is similar to doing polymer pneumatics, if you like, I think, because they are directed, okay? Or columnar liquid crystals, maybe, or something like that. Now, of course, there is a constraint here, which is divergence of B equal to zero, which translates into this. And you could write down, you can actually start from your pair interaction, coarse grain, and derive an equilibrium free energy, which is, again, nothing but B squared over 8 pi. So to quadratic order in the fluctuations of these fields from their equilibrium value, you'll get something which has a structure of this type, if you like. there are some elastic constants, a compressional modulus. You can compress the line. You can do it by changing the applied field. And you can tilt the line, and there is an elastic constant associated with that. This quantity can be calculated in detail. They're actually non-local, so really I should write this in wave vector, and this will be functional wave vector, but okay. And then you can calculate things like the equilibrium structure and compare to neutron scattering data and things like that. But I want to get to the dynamics. So what I would like to write are kind of coarse-grained equation of motion for this anisotropic fluid, if you like, now. And let me write them down. Well, first of all, there'll be, so clearly, this will always be there, because that's just divergence of B equal to zero. There'll be some kind of continuity equations. For the, I write them as two components, because I think it's easier to understand the physics. And I'm really going to be interested in linear order. But that's the density of lines. That's the local flow velocity of lines. And that's just the continuity for the density. I'll have also a continuity equation for this tilt field, which I will write this way. Okay. This is an anti-symmetric tensor. 2x2 tensor, which is the flux of this tilt vector. And so it only has one non-zero component, Jxy. Okay? And you can also show that these are simply, again, not exactly identical, but are another way. These really correspond to one of Maxwell's equations, of course. Because remember, the velocity of the lines essentially determine my magnetic field. So the velocity, the flux here, or the velocity to linear order, determines the field in the perp direction. And this Jxy actually determines the field in the z direction. Okay. So these are kind of a particularly unpleasant way of rewriting Maxwell's equation, if you like. Okay. Now, of course, these are my continuity equation. The fluxes are not conserved because the system is overdamped. I need constitutive equation for the fluxes to close them. Let me just try the one for V to linear order. So the one for V will be, this is overdamped, so I have my friction here. I'll have pressure type gradients, which will look something like this. These are nothing but those terms that when George gave us his lecture, these were the pressure, the magnetic pressure gradients, the gradient of B squared term plus the non-isotropic part. These are really, if you like, this contains magnetic pressure gradients and as well as some of the Magnus forces that are there even in equilibrium. Because this is just gradient of N, which is a density, and this is just gradient of T, which is another density. So these are really pressure gradients, which in this case are magnetic pressure gradients. Now, the term that people in this business usually don't write down is that what I said, now I want a viscosity because these lines are interacting. So just like in liquid crystals or any system which anisotropy, I have lots of viscosities. So let me just write some of these terms. And I'll have some, I'll have a bulk viscosity. Let me drop that. I'll have some viscosity for associated with the okay. And then if I'm driving the system, I have this Lorentz force, J cross. Actually, the Lorentz force should couple to what the local density, but let me just write it like this for now. It should couple to the local density, really. And so I have coupling to T as well, and then possibly thermal noise.
you don't want to calculate these viscosities?
I do. These I'm just written on the basis of symmetry. I'll have all these viscosities coming in on the basis of symmetry. But the one thing I want to do before I calculate them, I think I have 5 minutes, I can get to the point. One thing I want to do before I calculate them is show you what they do if they are large. And then I'll kind of tell you something about calculating them. If these viscosities are there, now I want to consider a simple case. Let me throw away the pressure gradients, which will be relevant to a shear type experiment. And let me only consider gradients in the plane. So let me just look at one simple form of this equation, where I only have the true shear viscosity and the Lorentz force. And the lines, say, are straight in the z direction. I guess I should have probably have the density of lines here, and presumably the flux quantum as well, something like that. Okay. Now, before I told you that when this term wasn't there, this was really Ohm's law, because I calculated my electric field essentially as 1 over c and not phi naught, which is the equilibrium field due to the line, z cross v. Okay. So using this, I can transform this into an equation for the field. And what happens is that now that equation becomes something that depends on 1 over gamma. Okay. So what this gives you is a non-local version of Ohm's law with a length scale, which is the ratio of the viscosity to the friction. And so what this says is that if you were to do, what people do in this thing is apply currents and measure voltages, but that if you have even just the sample boundaries, actually, or if you have any other kind of inhomogeneities in your system, these non-local effects, the field does not depend on the current at one point, but on the current at other points. If this delta is large, these non-local effects are actually important. And actually, they have been measured in these systems, particularly for non-locality associated with the Z viscosity, that is, situations where you might, say, drive the lines at the top and look how that response is correlated to the response at the bottom. Okay? They can get large. Yeah?
Resistance goes up with Q here.
Q?
Yeah.
What's Q?
Well,
Inverse length scale.
If the resistance goes up as you go to as you look at smaller scales, what's the physics of that?
If you want to define a wave vector dependent a local resistance, yeah. I guess.
I'm thinking of it as a wavelength.
I know. If you think about it as wavelength resistivity, a very large Q would be smaller. Why do you say that?
It looks like it goes up.
What you're thinking of saying is that E of Q equal rho F 1 plus delta square Q square J. Right? Now you want to look at what Qs is that? Tell me again. No, I think it makes sense. Generally, one looks, if you want to make contact with experiments, you look at the macroscopic situation. So you actually, but all I want to say is that experimentally, this kind of effect I've seen. And now, this, of course, is trivial to anybody who has dealt with liquid crystals or polymers or so on, but to people in the dealing with flux lines, it took a long time before they were willing to accept the idea of a viscosity, and also the idea that there is a difference between a viscosity and the friction. Okay.
In order to see these effects, is it primarily a matter of turning friction down by removing all the
interfaces? No. Quite the opposite. First of all, it's a matter of creating the right geometry. They can do amazing things in this system. So can eta be large? First of all, you can estimate it if you have point vortices in two dimensions, and the answer will be no. Okay. So then there are two things that can make eta large. One is in three-dimension entanglement, and that has been estimated, and the conclusion is that, yes, it can be made large, although you have to worry about the fact that these lines are a final barrier to cutting and reconnecting. And the other thing is phase transitions. even in two dimension, if you are near a phase transition from the liquid to the solid, or in the presence of disorder from liquid to another glassy system, then the viscosity may get large. Okay? So those are the two places where they probe it. And what they can do is, for instance, in three dimension, they can basically make this flux liquid flow in a channel with boundaries that pin the system over the entire boundaries. And these boundaries are actually defects which are there in some materials. Okay. Or they can engineer defects artificially. For instance, they can take a cylindrical geometry, they can make a core which is very dirty, an outer shell which is very dirty, and then drive the flux liquid like in quite to flow around the cylinder, and they can measure shear viscosity that way. Or they can drive a current through the core of these things, and they can get the lines to twist, and they can measure the, which I don't, the elastic constant associated with twist. So they can do actually quite all kinds of things. You have to know, play with the geometry a little bit.
Who is
they? Who are the people? There's a group at Argonne headed by George Crabtree, who has done a lot of these experiments, particularly in this, it's called the Corbino disk geometry, this cylindrical geometry. It's not really, it's a thick disk. That's why it's called the Corbino disk. There is somebody in Holland, Peter Kess in Leiden, who has done a lot of experiments actually in two dimension, putting things in channels and watching the, measuring the viscosity or the shear modulus of the vortex liquid near phase transitions. People at Bell Labs have done some of this. David Bishop and his people have done some of this too. But these are kind of that they focused on these known localities. No, actually, at Bell Labs they've done the experiments of putting a current at the top, and this now the role is really played by the boundaries of the system as well, and then measuring voltage at the top and the bottom and looking at the correlation. So there is quite an amount of, all I want to say, there is some experimental evidence that these effects are actually important. Now, I don't know, what do? Do I tell you why the viscosity can be large?
We'll have to take a very brief break.
Or if people care.
I mean,
I can probably tell you like 10 minutes why the viscosity can be large. And I was going to tell you something about loops, but the people don't care. I don't have to.
Breaks unrealistic. Let's do the 10 minutes. And then.
So I'll tell you why the viscosity is large, and then, okay. Well, actually, that's where some of the questions still lie, as a matter of fact. As I will tell you in a minute. In fact, actually, what I want to do is kind of raise two sets of open questions here. And I'll try to do it very, very quickly. So I won't really calculate viscosity or anything. I just kind of raise, as I said, kind of raise two sets of open questions. So the first question is, well, can this flux liquid really get entangled? And then the viscosity will get large. Well, the first simplest thing you can do is, let's go back to this single line. Which went like, this is a length, you could call it LP. Okay. So let's define a condition for, I don't know, minimal entanglement, whatever you want to call, when this is of order of the distance between two lines. So we define a length, we usually call it xi z, sorry. Okay. When this is of order of a square. And so you get xi z. Goes, actually, you can put in what this quantity is. Goes like 1 over the field times the temperature when you put in various things. How large can xi z? You can put in real number. And you certainly find that in bulk samples, this can be much less than L. This is for a single line. Now, if you're worried about a dense liquid, then you should worry about caging effects. Can the neighboring vortex line straighten up this line that is wandering if the system is dense enough? This has also been calculated in some kind of mean field way. And basically, what you can see that the caging effect of the surrounding fluid, of course, will tend to increase this length. But generally, for the situation we are interested in, of at most a factor of 10. So you might go, say, here an estimate could be 300 angstrom. You might go to 3,000 angstrom, although these are all kind of upper bounds. But, you know, we're talking about bulk systems, which are platelets, but certainly 20 microns or so. So.
You said that the barrier.
I won't get to the barrier.
Is there ever crossing of?
Yeah, this is a collision length, if you like. I like to call it a collision length, okay?
This looks a little strange, though. The more separate these vertices are, the more likely they get entangled based on this, because it's, see, Z is proportional to A squared, right?
Well, high field, Z gets smaller. Yeah, but because...
A is the distance between the flux lines, right?
Yeah.
The more separate, the bigger the A, the more entangled they can get.
Yeah. No, the other way around, sorry. No, the other way around. A low field, A is big, they're straighter. And at high field, A is small.
So what's the meaning of this C Z then? I thought that's the wandering distance.
It's the wandering distance, so.
It's a collision
length. Well, maybe this is too sizey. Maybe this is too sizey. Okay, but that's just a collision length. Okay, that's what that is.
So is this why the transition between the liquid and
no.
Is it tiny?
No, go on.
No, it's counterintuitive in the density, at least in the upper branch. You have kind of a reentrance transition.
The reentrance on the lower branch.
The lower branch is the
Oh, really? See, everybody in this business thinks this is very counterintuitive. This is entropic effects, actually. Here, the lines are far apart, and the melting is mostly due to entropic effects. Here, the melting is really just due to, you know, we have a lattice, big phonons, big thermal fluctuations.
Is it because the coupling is weaker? Because when you go to high fields,
the melting has to do with in-plane fluctuations, mainly, although not exclusively. But that's the melting. So suppose these lines were sticks, they would still melt. Although in that case, the melting temperature would depend on the thickness, and that's. But they would still melt. The melting has to do with in-plane fluctuations. Okay. Now, the question that is still not completely actually answered is, as this thing melts and loses correlation in the plane, does it immediately also get entangled, wander a lot like this? Some people have suggested that it first melts into a liquid, what they call disentangled lines, although that's hard to believe also for other reasons that will really exist in the thermodynamic limit of infinitely thick sample, and then it will go into an entangled situation. Most people believe that as it melts, it also gets entangled. Okay, in this sense for now, of collision length, if you like. Okay, that's all it does. Now, to estimate the viscosity, so then you, I mean, one way to estimate the viscosity, okay, now the other, I don't want to really do it, but to estimate the viscosity, basically, you can use what Tom was describing yesterday. Think of these entanglement tubes of length size E. Now, if you imagine projecting them in the plane, particularly, if you think of projecting them in the two-dimensional plane, they really do look like polymer. If you like, you estimate the viscosity of a gel, of an entangled gel, of segments of length size E by making the kind of approximations it was doing. So you would estimate the viscosity as a shear modulus, which is the shear modulus of this gel, times the relaxation time. Okay, so the shear modulus, well, I don't want to go through it, but from what he did yesterday, you could estimate it as something of this order. The question is estimating the relaxation time. Okay, now the relaxation time clearly is going to depend in a crucial way on how large the barriers for these lines to cut through and reconnect is. If they cannot cut through and reconnect, tau is huge, because then these lines can untangle or relax shear only by complicated moves in the planes at the top and bottom, not in three dimension, but in the planes. And then, this was actually estimated by Obukhov and Rubinstein, this goes like, I think, e to the l over xi z cube. So it's, you know, the viscosity is infinite, okay? If there are finite barriers to flux cutting, then basically what you can think about, two lines cutting through each other. The shear you know, the idea here is that what matters is the reorientation of these tubes of length psi z, which are now, you can think of them in the plane. Now, one of these cutting reconnecting moves will really only relax very little amount of shear. So essentially, what you want to estimate is the waiting time for one of these events of cutting reconnection. So you would estimate tau as some kind of more microscopic time scale associated with the rotational dynamics of these tubes of length psi z times e to ux over kvt, where ux is this barrier to line cutting and reconnecting, which depends on field and temperature.
I remember there was a paper maybe 10 years ago from Mankiewicz who actually made an analogy with living polymers.
Right. There's been some controversy between a paper of ours and the paper of Mankiewicz on whether we should have a factor of three here, but which is clearly very important if you know the barriers to flux cutting, but if you don't, it's not as important.
It was trying to take the effect of correlated crossing, because if you have one crossing, I mean, there are correlations in these motions.
The crossing has been looked in great detail. Maybe I'll just pass this around. These are kind of an example. They solve numerically equations that you have to include microscopies. But anyway. So the question is, things depend crucially on this quantity. How big is this quantity? People have calculated in various ways, but really what you have to calculate is the crossing energy for two lines in the fluid of other lines. Okay, the two lines cross with zero energy if they meet each other at 90 degrees. But to get them at 90 degrees requires quite a bit of thermal activation. So it's a very complicated microscopic problem. There have been a number of calculations. There are bounds. The bound indicate that this viscosity can get large. Okay, but it's still somewhat of an open question, actually, what exactly happens to this, although it's a microscopic question, if you like. But one thing this is very important for is the following. If the lines are straight, like in the lattice, you apply a current, the lines move, so there's no superconductivity in the plane. But if the lines are straight, if you apply a current along the lines, there is still longitudinal superconductivity, at least to linear order. I mean, you can excite helical excitations and so on, but bearing those, there is still longitudinal superconductivity. In the liquid, if the lines are entangled, there is no longitudinal superconductivity. If the lines are wandering, there is no longitudinal superconductivity because the current in the z direction couples to transverse vorticity and gets dissipation. But if these barriers are very large, for transverse vorticity to move and create dissipation, it has to cut and reconnect. Lots of lines have to cut and reconnect. So if these barriers are very large, there can be effectively a glassy type state just due to entanglement and still has longitudinal superconductivity. And these questions are still all rather open, not really answered. Okay. Yes.
When two flux lines cross, do they say they have to be perpendicular in the contact?
No. This picture, which is a microscopic calculation, claims that if you drive two flux lines to hit each other at some angle, first they repel. When they get close enough, they attract. So they go through one collision that basically send them back. Then they bend in such a way that they go through a second collision, and then they pass through each other. So it's a very complicated, and this is just two lines, there is nothing around.
Can they ever fuse?
Momentarily they fuse. See, when two lines fuse, they have four times as much energy because the energy goes like the flux quantum square. So they have four times as much energy. So, but the question is, I mean, do you really, well, okay. I promise to fuse.
They can't really break, right? Because of this continuity.
They have to reconnect. They have to reconnect.
So they can break, like for a short moment.
Well, they can fuse. I mean, your wording is better. They can fuse and then come apart again. I guess you don't. That's better than saying break and reconnect. Okay, but they can fuse and come apart again. And maybe you asked me a question about longitudinal superconductivity or something related to that. I forgot now.
It's well, you have a new question about
okay.
I mean, you have kind of a percolate, I don't know, maybe a percolating system when you have large settlements.
Percolating it this way?
No, I mean, if you look at the longitudinal conductivity, I mean, don't you have two systems which are in parallel? You have flux lines in parallel to support that conduction. So in principle,
well, the superconductor is a superconductor. So, but so there is no the dissipation comes from motion of flux. Okay, flux moving gives you dissipation, and flux couples to a current only if it's perpendicular to it. Okay, so if you have a straight line, strictly straight, nothing can make it straight line, and the current this way, there is no coupling.
But the network is kind of quite loose, so you have probably large gaps where the conduction, the current can go through without feeling the flux line.
She says she doesn't have a superconductor, she just means the dissipation isn't rigorous to zero.
I just mean that the linear, to be precise, I mean the linear dissipation is non-zero. That's what I mean. Okay. In fact, even in the crystal where the lines are straight, you know, there are fluctuations. You apply a current, it might couple to a fluctuation and amplify that fluctuation, but the linear dissipation will be still zero. There'll be some nonlinear effects. Okay. Now, let me just mention one more thing quickly. There is actually now a lot of interest in the following question. It seems, from some numerics, it seems that people describe people see a situation where you go from this kind of liquids, which we're discussing here, which is entangled, but it's still a liquid of directed line, to a liquid where actually loops proliferate, if you like. So a liquid that can be described more as a collection of interacting lines and loops that proliferate in the plane. And essentially what you can see then is that even in the presence of a field in this direction, you may still see a path of line, a path of field in the plane perpendicular. Okay. The orientation of the loops of all sizes and of all orientation, but in particular loops that lie in the plane, which are the most energetically costly. Okay.
Why would this happen?
Well, nobody understands this, but certainly there's been a lot of interest in going beyond this nearly directed line description, okay? And one way that I've looked at to do it is the following. If you have nearly directed lines, and you think of Z as a time, you can map the problem onto that of quantum mechanical particles in two dimensions, where the line is the world line, okay? If you now want to allow for overhangs and vortex loops, the problem maps onto the quantum mechanics of two-dimensional relativistic quantum particles, where the loop is a particle creation and annihilation process. And you can show the mapping, but then so what? They're both difficult problems. But the hope would be just like... No. One thing that has been useful about this, actually the mapping for the directed lines has been useful for many things. One of them is that you can actually see the hydrodynamic I was kind of alluding to more than describing here coming out from that mapping with some of the quantities calculated and so on. So the hope there would be that by understanding the hope would have to develop some kind of a continuum description of these relativistic, of these lines, directed lines and loops by borrowing from what people understand from relativistic quantum particles at the continuum level. So unfortunately, it's not all that much.
it's a funny problem where they interact with their past histories and future, but I mean, they're non-local interactions in time.
That's right, but these are, it's well known that loops map onto world lines of relativistic quantum particles. But this is what this system does. This is exactly what the system does, because if the lines are world lines, this thing interacts with this bit. So they have interactions which are non-local in time, you know, in both directions. And that's what is neglected in a lot of the work that has been done so far, by the way, okay, which I kind of...
Any experimental evidence that loops form, or is it just...
Numerical. Numerical evidence, okay? Now, in experiments, well, of course they form in type 1 superconductors. Well, that's another, kind of another story, but here it's... But so there is a lot of interest in figuring out basically how to describe the lines once you can get overhangs and loops. Okay, but again, nothing describe one line in a solvent or two lines or many lines in a solvent, in describing a collection of interacting lines. And in particular, in my view, if one could come up with continuum quantities to capture some of the feature of, you know, having the loops or having analog to the continuum quantity one uses for directed lines. I mean, I have some ideas how to do that, but I haven't been able to go very far. But if there was anything in your kind of literature that would be useful for that, that would be, I mean, that's really something that people are interested in. Anyway, I'll stop here, but I want to tell you that there is some experimental evidence for some of these things, although it's very indirect, so nobody really knows what's happening.
Order parameter of entanglement.
Like, but even more than that, well, I have some ideas actually for this, how you characterize loops by comparing to this relativistic analogy, but I don't think I want to bore anybody any further with them, but I...
But how fundamentally important is this equation? That this changes the foundation of the understanding?
Well, there are two things. Experimentalists, first of all, there are some experimentalists that periodically come up with a new second vortex liquid, meaning one vortex liquid and then a transition to another vortex liquid. Now, none of these vortex liquids is that well understood, so certainly the transition between them is. But so there is certainly interest, but experimentalists, there are, you know, there are very sharp features that one sees that identify the transition between two vortex liquids. And so it would be nice to understand that. So it does have possibly experimental evidence, experimental relevance, okay? From a theoretical point of view, I don't know, to me, being able to describe both lines and loops interacting with each other, that's a very important question. And, you know, to do so at some kind of a continuum level, which is funny because lines and loops lose their own identity in some sense at the continuum level. But I still think you can identify different continuum quantity to describe them. I mean, to me, that's an important question. I don't know.
I actually have a silly question about the phase diagram I want to ask you.
Okay. Sorry, went so long.
Thank you.